What is phase two?
New day is dawning. The day of the
Power Cosmic Podcast.
Gathered from around the galaxy comes the world's greatest comic book fans, all in one terrific podcast. It's the
Power Cosmic Podcast.
With your host with the most, the man who puts on Terrific Con, the world's greatest Comic Con every August at the Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut, Mitch Halleck. Joining Mitch each week will be an assembly of his terrific super friends. Join them as they talk about comic books, movies, and more. It's the Power Cosmic Podcast.
Power Cosmic Podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Power Cosmic Podcast. I'm your host, Mitchell A.S. Halleck.
Hi, I'm Jerry Ordway.
There you go. It's like... We sound like those people on Saturday Night Live, bad sketches. Hi, we're National Public Radio.
Right. Ooh, we're having a nice scone today with Jerry's latte.
Here's today's topic. It was thought about because of Howard Victor Chaykin.
Okay.
He's upset. Go figure. I don't think he's upset. He's just irritated. What he did is he did a post. I love reading Howard Chaykin's post. And what he did was he had issues with conventions using a certain book that he did over 40 years ago to promote his appearances. And that book being one of the books he doesn't like.
Star Wars.
Right. So it'll say Howard Chaykin, and all they did was show a big Star Wars graphic. And he wrote this whole, I don't know if you want to call it article or rebuttal or whatever. He said, listen, I've done many things, and that is taken from a time in my life when I just started. I didn't even know the craft very well. I was just beginning to learn stuff. I didn't stop there.
Right.
I continued on to this day where I'm still producing new material. Like, you just did that Hey Kids comics.
Yeah.
But it just, as a creator, it bugs him that they just anchor him with a book that he did over 40 years ago that he's not proud of.
Right.
He said he'll sign them. He doesn't care. People bring him to him the show. He gets it. It's a billion-dollar franchise, and he's associated with it. But it's kind of like that one-hit wonder type of thing where you're like a singer and you came out with... What have you done lately when you actually been
But they don't want what you've done lately. They don't want to hear about what you want.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to talk to you about. So I didn't want to tell you over at the pizza place. I saw Spring It on You. Now, you've been around since... We've already talked about this. Late 70s, 80s?
Well, comics, 1980 was my first professional.
And you've done All-Star Squadron, you've done Superman, you've done Shazam, you've done your own thing, Wild
Infinity
Star,
Inc. too.
Infinity Inc. and all that stuff. You did SpongeBob recently.
Right.
But you've done it all.
Yeah.
But have you ever got... What do you get labeled with, and does it irk you that people don't look at your whole career?
No.
But they just say, oh, that's the death of Superman.
It doesn't irk me.
No.
I mean, it's all fair game.
Yeah.
That you do wish, like when people say, hey, what have you been doing the last 10 years?
Right.
That you know you've been busy with stuff, but that nobody's been
buying
it. Or that
no one's been buying a lot of stuff.
Because things fall off the radar. Once you're not on like a main thing, you might as well be out of the business. So you could still continue to work and continue to have projects. But for example, like Action Comics 1000, I just saw the sales were like 500,000 for that.
That's good.
Yeah. No,
that's huge.
Everybody
nowadays
sees that.
Yeah.
But, you know, previously Human Bomb with Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray was a great 4-issue series, and that sold maybe 17,000 copies.
No. But when you said that 500,000, they had a lot of variant covers.
Yeah.
Are they lumping all those in as the total amount sold? Or
sure. Why not?
Really?
Yeah. That's how it works.
Okay.
But still, you got to figure you had at least out
people
of that 500,000, you still had like maybe 200,000 readers, and then you
add
the
extras.
That's
what I'm saying.
Extras.
A lot of people bought.
But it was a top book.
Yeah, and it was not cheap. It was like, what, 10 bucks, 8 bucks?
No, it was $7.95,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, because that's something there. So, you did a cover for that one there.
No, I didn't.
Oh,
I
wanted to. I thought we did.
Ouch.
No, we were going to do it.
Ouch.
Sorry.
No,
we were going to. Remember, we had it all planned,
but
it was too.
We couldn't find
it. It was
enough.
Prohibitive.
Yeah.
Because I think we had to get.
It would have cost 20 grand out of our pocket.
No,
unless we could find somebody to buy copies. You had to limit. It was a minimum.
It was a minimum
1,000.
Of 3,000 or 5,000.
I thought it was a minimum of 1,000, but they were.
No, it was expensive.
Yeah, but it's the cheapest you could get 1,000 copies
was like 13 grand or something.
It was expensive.
It was, because the problem we had is
we couldn't get stores that already ordered. The guys that we usually go to, Cave Comics, and also they already ordered their own. They couldn't cancel those orders.
And even at the show, because that came out in April.
It was multiple. It was a couple thousand. It wasn't 1,000. It was more than that. Yeah.
No, that's what people always ask me. Why don't you get a variant book for the cover? I still have copies left over from years before.
Yeah, it's hard to. Yeah. I mean, it's fine, but it is hard to sell. I mean, clearly they're still offering the Dynamic Forces had the double Jurgens cover. They had the double Jurgens one.
Right.
And they're still offering that in the catalog. I just saw it in the catalog. So, I mean, you know, you're going to be selling that. And it's fine. That's like a perennial, you know, people would still potentially want that in a year if they didn't buy it already.
No. But anyway, back to the subject at hand. And I was reading Howard's comments. I read his new series, the Hey Kids Comics.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, you read that book. Did you get all five issues?
Yeah. Yeah. It was... And it's funny because a lot of the stories that were in it are things that I knew. They're basic. I mean, he's basing it on real stories.
Yeah, real people.
Yeah, he's just framing it in his own narrative with.
Yeah, but do you have to know all the behind the scenes stuff to enjoy that?
No, not at all. No. But you could look at it and go, wow, there's no way that happened.
Hmm.
But there's at least rumors that those things did happen, like a guy being held outside of a window over a check.
Yeah, that's the Steranko story. Yeah, yeah. That's the famous...
But see, I heard it with Alex Toth.
I heard it was Steranko and Vinny Coletta.
Yeah. See, I mean, legends get blown out. I don't know.
Well,
maybe he did it with Vinny Coletta, and maybe it's a multiple incident.
No, and I don't want to say all the whole Chaykin thing, but he's in that book. He did that United States of Hysteria. Was that the book that was all the controversial stuff?
Right.
He did that. Before that, he did Satellite Sam.
Yeah, no, he's I give him credit. He's something. Always got a project going. And he did like S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff for Marvel. Yeah, yeah. Which, again, that you'd think that would be more relevant to an audience that you could say, you know, he did S.H.I.E.L.D. or he did a Nick Fury story or whatever.
Nick Fury, then there was that Power and Glory. There was American Flag.
Yeah. But, I mean, picking also his problem probably with the Star Wars is that he also
didn't get a lot of money quickly.
Off of it.
Yeah.
He didn't ink it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the guy who inks his stuff generally.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
You know? I mean, Howard's best work to me is obviously going to be older because it's the longest stretch. Like when he was doing American Flag, I thought that was a great book.
Oh, I did too. I used to get all that. That was the first comics to that.
But you almost have to do more than 12 issues of something to make that kind of dent in people's memory, I think.
No, but doesn't that
happen
with
everybody? Like a long run on a book.
I was going to say, but most people, I'm going to tell you right now, I'll throw some names out. You tell me if it's justified that. And I don't know if this means this is their greatest work ever, but somehow people always associate, like an actor has a certain movie.
Right,
like,
right.
Oh, there's that guy. He was in this movie.
Right.
Like if I say Walt Simonson, first thing people think is Thor.
Right.
But that was in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Walt's done many other books besides that.
He did a great job on Orion back in around 2000.
He did Manhunter when I knew him at the beginning of the
70s. But that was 73.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
but
that was
early. Saying, and then he did that run with Louise on X-Force.
He was on X-Factor. Yeah, he launched that with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he just did that Wonder Woman book. You just gave me a copy that just came out.
That was
it's available in stores right now.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the name of it? Wonder Woman and...
I don't remember what
the
it,
title.
It was something to do... Yeah, it was Walt. Like... It was
but I didn't even know it existed. It came out 2003?
Three, four, yeah, something
like that. Yeah. But I'm saying people get saddled with one way or another. It's just a shorthand I think fans have when they go, John Byrne, X-Men.
Right.
Even though he did the Fantastic Four.
Well, see, I immediately think of Fantastic Four.
Do you really?
John.
No, I just think X-Men. Maybe because that's the first book I saw him on.
Yeah. But I don't think that's unfair because obviously those books had some.
Well, what do you get labeled as, the Shazam guy or the Superman guy?
It's funny.
All-Star guy.
No, it's funny because I spent 7 years on Superman.
Yeah.
And I feel kind of like that was a, you know, when I was on there, it culminated in the return after the death.
Right.
That's when I left. But I was there for all the main storylines.
Yeah.
I got them engaged. You know, I was there. I came back to do the wedding stuff with Jurgens.
Yeah.
But I think people remember Shazam because that was really the last series.
But that was only 50 issues, 49 issues.
Shazam was like the... Yeah. It ended in 1999. So, I mean, that's still
that
20 years ago.
What was that, 3 years?
It ran from 96, 7, 8, 9.
Well, the graphic novel.
Yeah.
How long before the regular series after the graphic novel.
The graphic novel was about a year between 94 is when the graphic novel came out, and then 95 kind
but
of.
Do you, when you guys, when you see people at the shows, do they come up to you and think of you as, what do they ask you to draw?
Yeah, no. Shazam is probably, but Superman, Shazam. But then the Earth 2, I mean, I've done a lot of them, so.
Right.
And I don't have any problem with drawing any of them. I think
it's fun.
I forgot
you did Fantastic Four, because I never think of you as a Fantastic. I don't think of you as a Marvel guy.
Yeah, I did the.
You did that Avengers series.
I also did the Maximum Security crossover in 2000, and I did the Avengers 3 issues. I did a 4-issue miniseries, Avengers Domination Factor. That was like towards.
Who's that, Wade?
That was me. No, I wrote and
drew. Oh, you wrote that?
Yeah, and Juergens wrote and drew a Fantastic
Did
Four
they
Domination.
That one?
No, they haven't.
I was going to say, I don't see it.
It was basically 8 issues that tied together into one storyline.
Was
fun. It was a fun project, and it never got reprinted.
Who was the bad guy then?
The bad guy was kind of Loki.
Oh, see, no, I don't know. What year is this? Now I got to go out and find
That would have been early. No, I think it was like 99.
Oh.
Somewhere around there.
Oh.
It was before I did the Maximum Security, which was the crossover. So the Avengers, I did an issue of Thor over John Buscema.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my late 90s period. But in 84, I worked on Byrne for 8 issues of Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
I did, Fantastic Four, 3 issues of Fantastic Four around the 25th anniversary, which was 86.
Right.
And, that was... I mean, my Marvel career was short, but it was, I did a issue, I wrote like 3 issues or 4 issues of the Hulk back in the 2000.
What do you think, artists get saddled with a certain book when they're on for a long time as opposed to writers? Like writers, I can't, like if I think of J. Michael Straczynski, and I think of comics, I think of his Thor run.
Yeah.
But I don't, didn't he do that whole Superman?
I think of him for the Spider-Man run, because that was a
long
run.
Oh, the whole Romita?
Yeah,
with that.
Yeah.
Ezekiel, what was the character's name?
Well, he had he was like the main new villain kind of guy planted into the past.
I can't think of the guy's name. But no, that was a long run. That was like, what, a couple of years?
He was on it for a couple of years, yeah.
Like Dan Slott
and it was nice
Spider-Man for 10 years.
Yeah.
And I always think of Dan Slott as a Spider-Man guy.
Yeah. But I don't really, I think it depends on, like you said, it's what you read or what impacted on you is what you think. But it depends on what you're... I mean, at least if you have a couple projects that people remember you from, that's
Alan
good.
Alan Davis, Excalibur.
Well, see, I think of Alan Davis working on his Clandestine, because he wrote and drew that. And I like those. Those Clandestine came out in the 90s. And I think he
was that for DC?
That spun out of Excalibur.
Oh, I don't know.
It was for Marvel.
Was that it was like a magic book? Was it like Miss?
No, but it was
Doctor
like a team
Strange?
Book. It was a team book.
Oh, really?
And yeah, it was really a really good book. Yeah. I own like probably 8 pages from it I bought over the years. Yeah, yeah. It's
who was
nice
the,
stuff.
Who was the hero?
It was all characters he came up with.
Oh, there was his own?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. Were they in the Marvel Universe?
Yeah, yeah. The his issues have Spider-Man guest starring and stuff, too.
Wow,
so it's integrated. But it's kind of spun out of the Excalibur stuff.
So, do you get insulted when if I say you're coming to the show and I put the graphic up? I always do the most popular book you've done. And I can see why they did Star Wars with Howard. Is because that's probably the one people bring you the most, and that's people have it in their collection.
Right.
So when you, I'm sure they bring
you. Could
you
say Death of Superman.
Death of Superman or Power of Shazam.
I mean, yeah, Power of Shazam.
All Star
the
Squad.
The Batman movie comic was hugely successful.
Yeah.
That wasn't multiple covers. It had 2 covers for 2 editions.
Yeah, they had the newsstand
that thing
and
sold,
the premium.
Yeah, that thing sold probably like 400,000 or 500,000 at the time.
But you don't mind it, though. Maybe Howard's just getting Howard. On this one, it's like
everybody's
stop
different.
Bringing me the Star Wars.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, but I mean,
did more than that.
Look, when I first started, I don't think I was. I think I tried hard.
Yeah.
I mean, when you first start, you're not great.
No, you got to learn
but like,
with everything. Yeah.
In Howard's case, here's an example though.
He did Sorcery. I remember.
Yeah,
that.
But I remember loving that stuff when
what,
he did
Sword
and Sorcery.
Yeah,
the Fafner and the Gray Mauser or something.
Yeah.
No, I love that stuff. But I think it's because Star Wars was kind of out of his hands and maybe. A situation where, I'll do it, it'll be a page
that.
Rate.
I don't hear Roy
but it might
that
have been
resume.
It might have been that he has no emotional investment.
He does it when you talk to him. He
so
says it's just a
his,
job.
Yeah, that could be his deciding factor. Like something else you might have had to be more invested in that you'd say, this was my, why don't people recognize this because this is my favorite?
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? That does happen.
Well, I mean, like you just said, there were some titles I never heard of that you worked on. But sometimes you ever think, oh, no, my best work is actually ABC book. but no one read ABC books. Yeah. Do you have that where you're like, there's more to me than
what
the general public's like?
What was that Russian one you did?
Remember you did some book with
Red
somebody?
Menace. Red Shark?
I found pages of that one day. I called you up. And I said, they're on eBay for like $10.
Yeah, that was written by Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, the guys who wrote The Rocketeer. Flash and The Rocketeer, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He just passed away last year.
But I worked on that.
Who was that for, though? Because I saw
that was for Wildstorm. It was Wildstorm after DC bought him, but it was Wildstorm.
Did they ever put that in a trade? Or that's...
Yeah, that's in a trade. Oh. I think it's... I don't know if it's out of print now.
But I found the pages online for like $15.
It was a fun story. It's set in the 50s. It's set during the communist Red Scare.
Oh, you know? What's it has, about science fiction?
No, it's basically, it's a hero who has to go underground because he's taken, you know, brought before a Senate, a subcommittee of the Senate.
Russian?
Yeah, I even got to draw, you know, I mean, we did real people in there.
Yeah.
Like Roy Cohn is in it. Roy Cohn was the lawyer that obviously worked with Trump for years, but Roy Cohn was worked with McCarthy in the McCarthy era when they were doing
up people.
Yeah. So Roy Cohn's in it, McCarthy's in it. I mean, that was kind of fun.
So
it had like a historical base.
It's not something that somebody's going to go pick up like Spider-Man and let me get the latest issue of the Red Menace.
And somebody could be somebody's favorite. Like I did when I did the Tom Strong stuff.
Yeah,
that
those
was
are always really
like
fun.
98. Through the early 2000s,
that's all Alan Moore, right?
Yeah, and I did one like a 2-part story with Michael Moorcock after Moore wasn't writing it, and that was cool to work with Michael Moorcock.
Is that true? Alan Moore sends you these detailed descriptions of what every panel should be. And
yeah, and so you did it because it was beautiful stuff. I mean, he was very fully realized.
The narrative? Yeah.
His scripts were fully realized. It's like someone describing with minute detail, sitting in a room and describing everything that's sitting on the wall. I mean, it was impressive.
Really?
So if you didn't draw it, you felt guilty. You know what I mean? Like the guy went to the effort of realizing something that
like
fully...
We're sitting here in a coffee shop, but it's like an old factory. So he would sit there and describe the high ceilings.
He could describe what was on the shelves. You know, we got like some, you know, protein, whey protein
or whatever.
Did he
give you any creative freedom to do anything or draw?
Well, you drew, or directed, you say draw this. He gave you descriptions and you worked with it. Now, my favorite.
What if you didn't put something in? Did he ever send it back to you and say, I really want you to put that Cupid
doll? He was great. He just, you know, I think he was happy to see whatever.
Oh, really?
Like, I used to get feedback, which was funny. I used to get feedback from Dave Gibbons because Dave had obviously famously worked with him on Watchmen, also the DC Presents annual or the Superman annual with the Mongol story.
Oh, the Black Orchid?
Yeah. So Dave. You know, he would go, hey, good job. Because Dave knew what those scripts looked like.
Yeah.
You know, so we would have like a little running gag about that.
Like a Sears catalog?
It would come on my fax machine. It would be one continuous scroll, like 20 pages long.
For a 20-page book?
That would be maybe 7 pages.
No, really?
Yeah. It was crazy.
They would say panel one, this, panel two, panel three.
And it was always, if you look at those issues, there's generally no full-page splash. There were always like
a splash
with like 3 panels on it, or there would be a 9-panel page.
Well, the Watchmen's 9 panels, but that was taken off of the Wally Wood.
The problem with that is, obviously, when you're doing that, is you still have to leave room for the word balloons.
Right.
So back in those days, thankfully, Todd Klein was lettering that, so I could go through the whole script and do a layout. And lay out the figures really roughly, and then I could get the lettering. I'd put the balloon placements in it, and Todd would letter it, so I didn't have to draw behind the balloons.
You had the lettering done before you drew the panel?
I would do a layout.
Yeah.
That's how I worked on Superman when I wrote my own stuff, too.
Was that accurate?
Well, you'd stick figure out, here's where the figures are going to be, and then you knew how much space was going to be taken by the balloons.
Oh.
When I did Superman, I worked that way. When I was drawing it and writing it, I would do layouts. They were just scribbles.
Yeah.
And they had balloons. I'd type up the script. We'd get the pages lettered. They would come back to me. I would pencil them. And then Dennis Janke would come over to my house and pick up pages to take back to ink.
Oh, wow.
But it was a good way. Walt works this way still, even on his assignments and on his
Ragnarok.
He's still getting John Workman to hand letter pages because there's something about not wasting the effort, but also about knowing where the balloons are going to go. You can compose differently, so you don't, like, if you don't know where the balloons are going to go.
Oh, imagine drawing this elaborate landscape and then you get it. Well, and there's a big box over it, and you're like, what happened to the trees I drew?
Well, it's like we used to joke about that. Someone would have to put a caption in to describe what they just covered up.
Seriously.
I mean, that's like that was the old comic
over
thing.
Towards sea.
Right, it would be basically, that's working against the art. So.
Oh.
So it's, but if you're doing an Alan Moore thing, it was absolutely important to have all the dialogue down,
yeah,
because then you could make sure that the important stuff that he asked for in the backgrounds would show.
Right.
Otherwise, it's random. You could have.
When did that actually happen? Because I told you I was listening to this Grant Morrison.
The changeover to digital?
No, not that. I'm just saying he wrote. Like, I guess it's the History of Comics. I gotta put the title. So something about Superman or the coming of the great superhero, and he talks about the whole history of it. And he talks about back in the early 30s and early 40s when those guys were doing it just for a job because it wasn't very glamorous.
Right.
Where they'd start at 8 in the morning and by maybe 2 or they'd be up all night drinking coffee or on pills or whatever to keep themselves awake. And they were just pounding these stories out just to come up with a new story for an 8-page story.
Yeah.
Because those were only 8 pages.
Yeah, you'd throw like 8 guys onto a thing and it would be, that's where the factory set up.
It was
a
factory stuff. But they weren't like sitting there thinking of masterpiece and epics. This was throwaway entertainment.
Here's the thing, though.
No, I'm just saying, they didn't do it like, give me a guy from the 40s.
This is what people will remember.
Give me Alan Bellman. Right. Okay, he's doing a story. It's just a job. He's just going to get it out the door. He's not thinking they're going to look at this 80 years from now, 70 years from now.
Right.
He's just cranking this crap out, literally.
Yeah.
He's not worried about word placement or word. When did that suddenly now we're going to worry about the aesthetic of it and what the graphics look like and where the
but
blues
don't you think,
and the proportions.
Don't you think, here's the thing. What? If you look at my best example for this.
No, I'm asking do you know the answer to that?
Well, here's the thing, though. In 1940, first issue of Police Comics.
Police Comics.
Police
That's
Comics was
Plastic
quality
Man
or something.
And, yeah.
Police Comics had the first issue.
Spirit.
Has, the Spirit. It has Firebrand, which is the most throwaway character ever. It was drawn by Reed Crandall. If you look at this thing, if you ever see this issue, you know that Reed Crandall wasn't throwing this stuff away. He was doing it for posterity.
He
was putting... This stuff is beautiful.
I never heard of Firebrand. What's the character?
Firebrand, Roy Thomas created a female version in the All-Star Squadron. Had a pink shirt, like a see-through shirt, and the red,
she looks
tights.
Like a pirate shirt.
Yeah.
Oh, that's I know.
But there
what
was a male
about,
version of it. That's how in Police Comics, and Roy had her. Basically, I was her brother who got hurt in World War at the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So she takes over his
mantle. I could see it in my head.
But the original story, Reed Crandall, he was doing stuff for the ages. He wasn't drawing throwaway stuff. You could tell if you look at the stuff; it's beautiful.
Really.
Now the same is true, and it's not everything. I think the same theory could be applied to any era, that some people worked for the work.
Yeah.
They didn't work just for the paycheck. They were still making their deadline. Mm. Wally Wood stuff is a high bar.
Yeah.
Reed Crandall did stuff even up through the 60s that was always fantastic.
I gotta go look that up.
But there's certain people, I think it's all part of the artist.
Like Will Eisner just bangs some stuff out, then he goes off to the war, then when he comes back, then he really gets his groove going.
Yeah.
And then from like 1946
to...
52? Yeah. Whenever did those are really now? Those are all well drawn.
And he was working for the. But he was working for a newspaper syndicate.
Yeah.
Where the bar was already high because you had Prince Valiant, you had Flash Gordon by Alex
Raymond.
That's why the
spirits looked a lot better.
Well, you were competing against those guys if you're working in newspaper comics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those guys set a high bar. Milton Caniff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Amazing
Jerry
writer.
And the Pirates.
I mean, people think of the art, but those stories are great. So that's the thing. I mean, in comics, you just need one guy to show everybody up, and it brings everybody else up to that level, at least to attain or try to get that
level. Is it easier being the writer and artist on a book because you have it in your head and you know exactly? Like being a writer, director in a movie and an actor because you write it as you're going along.
It is,
you know how
but,
it looks.
But the way the Marvel style where you work plot, you write a
and
plot
then
and
the
then
story.
You adapt to the artist. That's the best way because the artist always brings something that you did not have in the plot. Even if it's something that they missed something that you had, that always happened. Like you'd put something that was here's an important element, and when you get the pages back, it's like, wow, it's not there. Mm-hmm. Did the guy just miss it? It was important to me. I didn't say how important it is to him.
Right.
You know, but you work around it and something better comes out or something different. And that's the creative part of it that was fun. That's the collaboration part where it's not just, here's what you have to draw. You have to draw it or else you're in trouble. It's like, here's an idea, adapt it however you want. You get to throw your own ideas into it. It comes back and it becomes part of something done by two people rather than one guy dictating.
Yeah. So the DC method before Marvel got into it, they would give full scripts to an artist.
Everything was laid out.
And
everything
said,
was
just do this. Yeah. So there wasn't much leeway.
No, and in like the EC comics, the funny thing is you don't really think about this, but EC had, in a lot of cases, they would lay out the stuff so that the lettering could be done, because most of those EC guys would pencil and ink.
Yeah.
So it was almost I think the process is close to what Walt did, which I copied for my Superman stuff, where you do a rough scribble.
Is that why those EC books are so word-heavy, text-heavy?
Well, they were also lettered by a machine. Not a machine,
they
but they were lettered by
the
a template.
The speedograph, wasn't it?
It was like a panagraph. You know what a panagraph is?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It would go through like the groove of letters, and that would transcribe the letters onto the art.
That's how they did it?
Yeah. So it looks machine-like. It's not typeset.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Yeah.
No, it was a machine. It was a machine, like I said, a mechanical device.
That's why the font is so heavy too.
They couldn't change the size of the font.
They all
so it was all
very
deep.
Uniform. Yeah. And I was like, why does this look that way?
So they would often. I think the artist would get those things already lettered,
and
so with the panel breakdowns, the borders already broken down.
Oh wow!
So they would fill the art into it.
I always wonder why that looks so heavy. Whenever you see an EC book, it's like, geez, this is a novel.
Well, you remember, you might not remember, but Charlton Comics had like a kind of a crappy
printing
lettering
process.
Thing too at one point. Do you remember that?
Charlton was crappy.
They tried to use like a typesetty kind of looking thing. I think somebody must have found.
Somebody was throwing it away in the trash and
or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
But I always felt like the collaboration stuff has always been the key to making both parties interested, and that's why I don't buy into everybody was just doing it for $5 a page.
Yeah.
I talked to Jerry Robinson back during the Batman movie time. Yeah. I did a bunch of shows with him in '89.
And he's the Joker.
He was. I think he created Robin.
That was always his
contention, and it made sense because his name was Robinson. He was a kid when he worked for Bob Kane.
I always thought it was based on Robin Hood, they said.
Go figure. But Joker, he was also definitely a part of that.
I heard the Joker described the other day, and the same thing I was telling with Grant Morrison, I never looked at he's supposed to be like a riverboat gambler, you know, from those guys that you see like in the... I don't know, 1860s?
A dandy?
Dandy. That's what the Joker's original outfit was.
Right.
With the clown make. I never realized that his costume was
He's got the boat. Because he's got a bolo tie.
The bolo tie and the jacket. He's supposed to look like one of those guys you would see like in Maverick.
Yeah.
You know that show that was on with Roger Moore, was it?
Maverick was, it was early...
Yeah,
James
he's
Garner,
a riverboat gambler.
James Garner.
James Garner.
But he was on it, too. He was Bo Maverick.
Yeah, his
Roger
British
Moore.
Cousin.
Yeah.
But no, so that, I never looked at the Joker as wearing that suit.
But Robinson, here's a good, again, I'm not trying to totally put Grant Morrison's theory to a test.
It's just another thing to read, that's all.
But Jerry Robinson liked his work enough that he contrived to get it back from the printer. So he had his covers that he did, the Batman covers that he drew. He drew the one with the Joker with the calendar pages. He drew a bunch of classic Batman Joker covers.
Right.
And he tricked DC into getting the art back from them.
What's that?
By going in the office. And he used to tell me this. He said, if you wanted your artwork back, if you thought it was valuable or if it was important to you, you could get your artwork back.
Yeah.
So most people didn't because either they weren't in the office long enough or they just didn't want to go to the extra work. But what he did was he'd go in the office while he was dropping in a job. He'd say, hey, can I use the phone for a second? He would call the color separator from the DC office.
Yeah.
And he'd say, hey, I'm calling from the DC offices. Can you set aside, send that cover to Batman or Detective back to the office?
1, 2, 3,
attention Jerry Robinson.
Right.
So the next time he'd come in, that cover would be sitting in an envelope. Nobody asked. They just said, oh, hey, something came for you. And he would take it home. So
prior to that, they were just throwing them away, weren't they?
Well, they would, they stockpiled them. They put them in a pile in a storeroom.
To do what with them?
They just piled them up.
I heard the story of Marv and Roy or somebody
but they were doing that because it was a giant. There were giant piles, and they just wanted to free up storage space.
Right, and some of the guys started taking some of the pages.
So they would cut them carefully between the panel borders rather than a diagonal, and then they would grab them out of the garbage at the end of the day downstairs. They would take them home and tape them together. So
it was just junk. Who cared who took it?
They did.
Who did they? The company?
The kids. Marv and, DC, and anybody.
They were just throwing them away. So what difference does it make if they took it home or they had to cut
well,
it
Well, they didn't. Officially, they couldn't. That belonged to the company. So for tax purposes, I think, they had to destroy it. Oh. Right. Because it would have value.
So prior to that, none of the artists ever got their pages back.
Unless you contrived to get your artwork back. Yeah, there was ways to do it. It's just that it was harder. You know,
it was
you had
not
to go.
Until the 70s when Neil starts the big campaign, Neil Adams,
right.
that they started actually getting returns.
Right. And he made the case that they technically, if they gave the art back, because I think the reason they had to destroy it, someone probably has a better...
Was it copyright?
No, it was a tax thing.
Really?
Because if you kept it, it was inventory.
Yeah.
Think about this.
Yeah.
Like if you're assessed
if I get
a property tax,
books from the show,
it's based on what
yeah.
you have there as your inventory.
But
you have to pay a tax
it,
on
it's
it.
Just,
right.
Yeah.
If you destroy it,
it's a loss.
In theory, has no value.
Right.
Neil's point was, you're also not paying the artist sales tax. Most of the artists worked in the New York area at the
yeah.
time, and if you're actually buying the physical artwork, the company
oh,
should have
the
had to pay
sales tax. Yeah, okay.
And there's no sales
okay.
tax involved, so therefore no exchange of
well,
anything other than the images.
It's convoluted, but I can see
that
it.
Was his argument, yeah. as I recall.
Yeah.
And again, maybe somebody's got a better read on that. But
all right. Well, that's a brief history of the story. But here's one for you. We talked about collaboration, this and that. Have you ever had some guys that were like Marv Wolfman, I think, of Teen Titans, right?
Yeah.
And then Perez, who we just talked about, who's coming to the show, by the way, George Perez will be here one day only. They worked together to collaborate on
yeah.
that stuff. But if you ask George what his greatest book is, immediately, he'll probably say Wonder Woman.
Right.
But I think of Teen Titans. If you ask Marv what his greatest work is, what did he say? That he'd probably say Crisis.
I don't know.
So I'm just saying you get different people, but the
right.
fans identify with it. To me, Marv Wolfman's Teen Titans and Crisis.
Yeah.
But he also did Nova.
Well, I think of Dracula.
Night Force.
Tomb of Dracula was a
oh,
good
that's
book.
Right. That's
yeah,
his
yeah.
too. See, I
yeah.
don't even think of that. But that's a huge Marv Wolfman
yeah.
book.
Yeah.
See, maybe it sucks to pigeonhole people on what they did, but Marv's still working now.
Yeah.
You just did something
yeah.
with him. Primal.
Yeah.
Book. So it does kind of... It's like being a rock
but,
star.
But you
like
can't
I told
be
you,
a,
it, like...
Well, right, but like a rock star, you're
like
going to go.
Springsteen's
so you
still coming
go
out with new material.
Right, but
he still sings his golden oldies.
Right, and that's why you shouldn't be bothered necessarily by it, because it's out there and somebody loved it. So let them have it. You know what I mean?
But when they advertise you, I think Howard's point was, he said, don't put a picture of me with Star Wars.
Right.
Put a picture of me with that, maybe
right.
amongst.
But what was bigger than Star Wars? That's the
no,
the thing. What
nothing.
Is, you know what I mean? Not, and he's done some
that's
great
just,
stuff
yeah.
over a long period.
Right.
But the name recognition
yeah.
wise, Star Wars is the biggest name recognition.
And that's going to bring people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
like
I mean,
Bruce Springsteen's, when he was doing his Broadway show, he goes, hey, I'm Mr. Born to Run.
Right.
I'm Mr. Fucking Thunder Road. That's
right.
what he says.
Right.
Because that's, oh, that's the guy.
Right.
Dancing in the Dark.
And some artists don't like doing old stuff.
Oh, I know. There's nothing worse than going to a concert with a guy you like and
right.
they don't sing any of their old stuff.
Right.
Here's all my new album
right.
and you're like, I don't want to hear this.
But I understand that as an artist,
yeah.
it's like, okay, here's what I'm doing now.
But as a
don't
fan
focus
who paid
on what I did.
Hundreds
yeah.
of dollars to
yeah.
see you. They want to hear the stuff that made them like you.
Right. But that again, so I mean, it's all fair. And again, you if you sing a couple of the big hits, then
yeah.
that should appease people.
I guess it's different if you're an actor. Because I had the guy
well,
from
Clerks. Well, you
can't
go back in time.
No, I had the guy
right?
from Clerks. I talked to him once. I said, do you mind being identified with Dante? With
right.
Brian O'Halloran.
Right.
He said, no, it's fine because they come out, they remember, and you sign their autograph. But when you try to act up, like if he showed up at shows
right.
dressed like he did from 1993 or
right.
2, whatever
right.
it was, then people go, oh, isn't
trying
that
too
sad?
Hard. Right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like showing up wearing... If
right.
you were
right.
if you were Batman and you show up wearing Michael Keaton's walking around wearing the bat suit,
right, right,
it would be embarrassing,
right?
Because he's 60
You'd
something.
You'd be embarrassed for
him,
them.
Right,
right. right?
It's like a circus clown. Like I would see,
and yet I still wear the costume when I go to shows.
You're wearing it right now, actually. Larry Storch, I see him at shows. He's still around.
Yeah,
he's,
yeah.
I think he's 99.
Yeah,
and he's still sitting there with that hat on.
Yeah,
that
with the arrow
F-tree.
Going through.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But that's what he's remembered for.
Right.
Like Steve Martin, I remember, speaking of Arrow Through the Head, that's what
right,
I remember Steve
right.
Martin as. The
right.
white suit, Arrow Through the Head, but he's done tons of work
right,
after that.
Right.
To me, he's still the wild and crazy
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, yeah. But that's just, again, there's nothing wrong
I
with
think
that.
People just do that naturally.
I mean, the best thing you can argue for it is, look, at
they
least you did
it.
Something
that
impacted people.
Yeah.
And if you only had one thing, that's fine. But the problem is when you have a lot, people still tend to focus on that
one
thing.
Thing. But do they want you to keep doing it, though?
Well, I do sketches of Superman and Shazam are probably the most popular for sketching.
Yeah.
And I don't care. I don't mind.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've done so many of them, it's still not a problem.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I still like drawing those characters. It's like not like...
John Romita.
If I'd been doing it for 40 years straight with the one character, I could see where people are like, you know, please don't let me, I don't want to have to do it again. But I've always had breaks. You know?
I never think of John Romita as a Daredevil guy.
Yeah.
Never.
But that
I
was his
think of
start.
Spider-Man, but apparently that's where he started, on Daredevil.
Yeah. And he did it was his first return to Marvel.
Yeah, yeah.
Working over Kirby layouts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The first one specifically, Jack did the rough breakdowns.
Yeah, yeah.
Stick figures and panel breakdowns.
And then John Romita came
to show him how to do Marvel style, because Romita had worked full script before that. He was working on romance stuff. It was all full script. So, yeah.
But there are some guys like Alex Ross. He's not really a comic book guy. But whatever he does currently, that's the latest greatest. I don't think people lump him in as he's done, he's retired.
Well, they're doing a retrospective edition of Marvel's.
Yeah, I saw that.
Isn't it 25
that.
Years?
Yeah. Is it that? Yeah, 25 years. And Bill Sienkiewicz is another one. Bill's doing stuff now.
And Bill still does stuff.
Every
it's not
day
like
he does
but I'm saying he still does covers once in a while. He's still, you know, he'll do. It's not like he's been out of the business.
Yeah.
But his big thing was when he was on a regular book. That's how people look,
because
it's a long
just
run of something.
That guy. And then that Daredevil graphic novel.
Well, he did the. I remember his
New Mutants.
Well, I was thinking New Mutants when he did the crazy that. Not robotic, but the...
Yeah, the Legion.
No.
It's...
What is his name?
Oh, it's black and yellow, and he's got that crazy...
Yeah, he could be any shape.
Is it Warlock?
Yeah, yeah, maybe.
Something like that. Yeah, I remember that. I know people were screaming.
And then he did The Shadow at DC for a bit. He did The Shadow.
I was checking. Kyle Baker, wasn't it? And
Bill did it first, and then passed it on to Kyle.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I was thinking it was Chicken.
Yeah, it was Howard wrote it. Chaykin did
the prestige version of it, and then
they launched a regular book, and Howard wrote the regular book, I think, initially.
Yeah, I would collect that.
Yeah.
It never ended, either. They never finished that story. It got canceled just before it wrapped itself up.
And it felt like the movie based used some of that.
On Howard's thing?
Yeah.
Well, it had the same villain.
But it had that, you know, I don't remember a lot of emphasis on the drug.
Opium den, underground.
Yeah, all that stuff, definitely.
Lamont Cranston.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was that, too. Like... You know what comes out this week? I think the Robert E. Howard. Today's Robert E. Howard's birthday as we record this. The Conan guy.
Yeah.
Roy Thomas, Conan.
Yeah.
He's got multiples. I think when people think of Roy Thomas, they think of Invaders, All-Star,
Avengers. Yeah.
And Conan.
Yeah.
Because he's done those four books.
And he did runs on Spider-Man. He did runs on...
He did four issues on Spider-Man.
Didn't he do the multiple arm Spider-Man?
He did the multiple arm stories, and then Spider-Man goes to the Savage Land.
Savage Land,
101 to 104.
Yeah,
and that's it, though. But he's not a Spider-Man guy.
But yet the multiple arm thing has been
enduring.
Oh,
yeah, it's iconic.
Yeah.
They just came out with a figure of that.
Yeah.
And then Jerry Conway does the Punisher. But Jerry Conway's also the creator of Firestorm.
Right, with Al Milgram.
Al Milgram,
yeah. And Firestorm looks exactly like that 1950s character.
With the original
Nuclo or something. There was a publisher that went out of business. But that costume is pretty close.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, you know,
and he was a nuclear
Trump,
character.
Right?
Could have been.
Trump had a character.
There was a character
like
who had the red and yellow.
Yeah.
It was pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, I'm not trying to dismiss that. I'm just saying it's always funny, kind of like with the Black Terror was this big character in the 50s or late 40s.
Isn't that the Black Terror?
Jerry Robinson and Mort Meskin did.
Yeah.
And it was for a publisher that went out of business, and Alan Moore kind of grabbed some of those public domain characters for Tom Strong.
Yeah.
And he did those multiple world stories, but he had the Terror. He called him the Terror instead of the Black Terror.
Uh-huh.
But it was the same guy. He's got a skull and crossbones and a black costume.
What was the Shield? Is that Archie Comics?
Yeah, Archie was the Shield.
Which is basically Captain America. Wasn't there a
but
lawsuit?
But it was 19... The Shield
was the
started
40s.
In the... Four,
yeah, because they had to
that.
Change
yeah.
the Shield
yeah.
because they said it was too close.
The Shield
the
was
triangle
first.
Shield.
Yeah, the Shield I think might have been
Cap's.
First.
It was, and that's why they had to change Cap's thing to a circle.
Yeah.
It was all the same.
Red Circle. It all comes full circle.
Red Circle Comics.
That was, no, I'm just saying, like.
That was Atlas, wasn't it?
No, that was Archie.
Oh, that's what they called
it. Yeah.
Them.
Archie had the Red Circle line in the 80s because Rich Buckler.
Oh, yeah.
Buckler was working on All Star Squadron.
And then he left.
He drew four issues, and then he suddenly left. I guess he had a contract that he'd abandoned the contract because Archie offered him the deal to edit that Red Circle line, and he basically burned his bridges at DC by leaving
but
in the middle of a contract.
That didn't take off at all, though.
No.
No.
I mean, there's some interesting stuff that he got done during that time. There's
it's always weird to find out stories companies that just never really took off, and you're like, what was Wally Wood's thing? Heroes, Inc.?
Yeah, but Wally Wood worked on Thunder Agents. Tower Comics.
Cool. Tower.
And Tower was, I think, owned by the guys who did Tops.
What was the one where you'd go to that Black Cat Comics and I would find books and I'd hold them up to you and go, what the hell is this? And you go, oh, that's... What was the Archie, the superhero one?
When Archie did the... You mean with the Private
Crusaders,
Strong?
The Mighty Crusaders.
Crusaders, right?
Yeah. It looked like a superhero line.
Yeah. They just...
And the fly in it.
Not everybody could compete with Marvel. You know, it's...
But the stories
at that
were
time,
probably just as cool.
The stories might have been comparable to DC stuff,
okay.
But it was in that vein, whereas Marvel really did reinvent those dynamic. You know, the group books were all about conflict, whereas the DC and the traditional stuff was everybody gets along because you're all in the...
one big happy...
You're in the Elks Justice Club League. Or something,
yeah.
You know what I mean? That was the setting.
We used to describe that as that. We would always say DC was like your father's, like when you were in the early 70s, you would see the... What's the guy's name? Frederick Murray or...
Right.
Father Knows Best.
Yeah.
They'd have the pipe
right.
And the easy chair
right.
And the martini. And
but I do think of it more as like the gentleman's club or the group like that, like the Elks Club or the Shriners.
The
Shriners were
the
ones.
Yeah.
It's an organization where everybody generally got along.
Marvel's more the beatnik on the street corner.
Where everybody...
Pot-smoking hippies.
And they all disagreed. They were more...
Yeah, they always fought.
They were like the battling family.
Yeah.
You know, the Avengers, they fought.
Constantly.
That just amazed me. That was the hook for me, because I had...
And no other comic line
I had brothers, and
that.
I fought with my brother. You know, we loved each other, but we'd fight.
The only one that... So it was Green Arrow and Green Lanterns, the first time DC tries that?
I think.
When
maybe.
Danny O'Neill writes a story where they, you know...
Although...
He's a goody two-shoes, and then the Green Arrow's like a...
In fairness, Len Wein wrote Justice League for a period of time in the
Before
70s.
That?
In that same time frame, I think, and he tried stuff like that. I think he, you know,
the elongated man was having a fight.
I never read those at the time.
Yeah.
But in seeing stuff years later, I'd go, wow, you know, he was trying to instill a little bit of that Marvel energy to the stuff.
Yeah.
It's just that it was resisted, I think, from editorial because these guys all were there for years and years and years, and they knew how to do things. So Julie doing. Like the Green Lantern, Green Arrow was a big deal.
Too,
yeah,
right?
Julie was already established.
Right.
He would have been in his probably 50s in the 70s.
And all these guys are in their 30s. So
yeah, maybe he would have been 60.
Because
yeah.
Mort Weisinger's writing Aquaman in the 40s.
Right.
And he was around in the 60s.
Right.
So, yeah, you got these young punks, and I'll tell you what to do.
Yeah. And that was the whereas Marvel, Stan Lee was like the aging hippie.
Yeah, basically.
So
yeah.
Once, you know, Stan was probably what in it, I think when they said when
well,
Fantastic
he
was
in World
was,
War II, so
but when Fantastic
to...
Four was created, Kirby was like 40, so Stan would have been 30.
Eight.
Yeah,
no,
seven,
he was,
37,
well,
36.
Stan just died 95. Yeah, he was 5 years younger than.
Yeah.
Kirby, because Kirby's 100.
But that's the right kind of cusp for being okay. I'm happy to
try.
Be a hippie.
Yeah.
I'm going to try for these kids because I'm still
these
kind of
kids.
A kid.
I still call people kids now.
And
people
I mean, Jack was
52.
Being older. Jack had a lot of children, and I think having kids,
he's 60.
But having kids over that long span kept him
young.
Even when he was still, you know, I mean, like maybe the dialogue was a little clunky, but he was still getting the fact that kids wanted new stuff.
When he did his
like the Forever
Mr.
People,
Miracle, and Forever People, New Gods, he tried.
Yeah,
I'll give you that because
but
I've
he
read
still
him.
Had,
he
and
tried.
Again, it was
he's
because
to hook with that
because
younger
it's like when my kids were little and they were growing up,
yeah.
I knew what every craze was because
so
I was buying those toys and I lived through Pokemon, I lived through Yu-Gi-Oh, I lived through all those.
I
lived
through all that. That's why when I do the GamerCon, the people go,
now,
"How do you know what's into it? You're 52 years old. I don't have to play the games.
Right.
I just have to look at what my 18 and 20 year old.
But see,
do.
For me now, I've lost that connection.
Oh, yeah.
Because my kids are grown.
The only good thing is I know what's going on in the comic book world because that I got that covered. No one's touching that, you know. But I do got my stack of comics. That's
but
a
they're
problem
not
too.
They're not writing comics for you necessarily.
I wonder
you know,
about that.
Your audience is probably under 40 is who they're
the new
targeting.
Immortal Hulk just came out by Al Ewing and those guys. It's really well done.
Yeah,
it's just a good story no matter who's doing it. I'm like, oh, I wonder if he doesn't care.
Yeah. Well, it shouldn't. It should be general.
They should write a book like this is aimed for a 50-year-old guy.
It should be general. I mean, it shouldn't necessarily be that you have to, you know. But I'm just saying,
but
like,
isn't
if
that
you're
the average demo, though?
If you're 30 years old and you're writing it,
you should write to other 30-year-olds.
You're going to write to your like, age group because that's what you know.
Like when I met last year at the show, Charles Soule was at the show and he just did Daredevil. Nice guy. I just talked to him a lot. He's nice, but he's I don't know how old Charles Soule is. I'm going to say he's in his 30s. I'm 52. He's writing books for people that might not have read it. I have friends, that kid Mike Scalise.
Right.
He thought that last Daredevil story was amazing. Oh, my God, did you see what Charles Soule did? I go, it's good.
Well, we've been through, though.
I've already read this. It's kind of like when they would remake movies.
Yeah.
And I told you I had to go see King Kong. And I thought it was the greatest thing ever. And I come home, my dad's like, I already saw that with Faye Ray, but I saw it with Jeff Bridges. And then my kid sees it with Jack Black. Right. It's like, they just reinvent that audience.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that as a when you could see
there's
how
so many times you could tell the same story.
Could see how a movie reviewer, for example, at age 50 or 60 could be very jaded because you have seen everything.
Right.
So
well,
it's,
we do it.
No, I'm saying. And that I always try to preface that by saying, look, you know, it's probably not targeted at me because I've seen
like
every
Aquaman.
Other right. I've seen every other iteration of this. And it's not going to surprise me. And if it's going to surprise me, it may be too wild for someone young. You know what I mean?
I sit back and I sit there and I was like, why is Aquaman making so much money? It's not that good. It's dumb. But then I have people with kids and they saw it and the kids love it because guess what? They haven't seen Flash Gordon. They didn't see the variations of this movie.
Right.
It's all fresh to them. My kids like the Star Wars prequels. I was like, are you kidding me? But to them, they were 7 or 8.
But see, I liked them. I really didn't dislike the prequels.
And my dad
I enjoyed
hated
them.
Star Wars. Yeah. When I was a kid, I saw Star Wars 13 times the summer it came out. My dad didn't see it once. He goes, I always saw that when it was called Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers on TV.
I still remember so vividly. I was working at this art studio before Superman, the movie, came out in 1978.
Yeah,
And it was like maybe October, so there was just starting to do ads, and there was like a newspaper ad with the big
clouds.
Streak and the, you know, you'll believe it. I remember I was, at that point, it was 1978, so it was like 21.
Yeah.
It was 21. I'm really kind of excited for this.
Count the days.
And one of the guys who worked at this art studio,
he
was probably in his 40s. He just looked down at the newspaper at that thing,
he goes,
they're making a movie about a comic book character. And he walked away, and I was just like so crushed. But that's still true in a way. And now that they've become, that's become the action movie almost.
Right.
You know what I mean? Action movies don't exist really because the superhero
movie
is taken
over.
But you could see that attitude of somebody who probably saw Superman in the serials or the TV show and just was like, I don't need this.
I'll give you this though. Who was I just reading a review last night? They said they couldn't stand a certain movie because the writing was so poor. I just read somebody's remarks about it. But even the bad movies in the 70s, because there wasn't so many of the movies being made, they were still better crafted.
Right.
Even a bad movie had a better script, better dialogue, better acting maybe. But because there wasn't 20 movies a week. It was like 20 movies
a year.
But
think about this.
What?
What
didn't
they have?
I'm just saying that. Maybe that's
what didn't they have back then?
Special effects.
No.
Money?
It's even worse. Back then they didn't have the ability.
Social media.
They didn't have the ability to basically distill every element of it and run it through a program. You know what I'm saying?
Like spoon feed you, like test market it?
Yeah. I mean, when they did that, back in the 70s, you would have a guy who sat at the head of Paramount who maybe was there for a long time.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, this guy's going to be gone in a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Those guys had long tenures. So they would sit at the head of the studio and they would make gut instinct.
Right.
They would say, just like with comics, they'd say, okay, it looks like cowboys are in.
Yeah.
Yeah, no problem, we'll do a Western.
Right.
They didn't micromanage.
And then something would come out of left field that they didn't see. And
it wasn't micromanaged to death. So basically you had people who knew how to write a story.
Yeah.
And they weren't... No one babysat them, so they could write a story.
It
now,
was a business, but not as
once
overtly
it, right.
Corporate.
Once it becomes about number crunching and all this,
and shares,
it changes because then you have instead of having the creative people, you have like 25
you know
other
what?
People with an input, including maybe the producer's wife who thinks Zumba is the newest thing.
Yeah,
so you
got
to put a Zumba scene in a movie. That's the stuff that
back then we'd have Xanadu or Roller Boogie,
and those were perceived as big movies. They were going big for
stupid.
They were trying to follow a trend.
Right.
But in general, 90% of the movies were just movies that, hey, this made, you know, like Clint Eastwood could do a Western that would make money, then somebody else would go, hey, Westerns make money, we'll do a Western. They weren't going like, oh, why did the Western succeed when it, you know what I'm saying?
No, nobody really. They didn't analyze
it. They went on
it.
Gut instinct.
I was sitting there watching Netflix the other day, and I just had it going as I was drawing. And this movie came up called Io, one about the moon of Jupiter.
Okay.
And everybody's left the Earth.
And this is, people are talking this up now. I think I've seen it on the Twitter feed.
It recommends movies for you, because I'm drawing, it says, we recommend this movie based on your previous, because you like science fiction, we think you'll like this. I'm like, okay, fine. And it's this
because
girl,
you watched Nymphomaniac, we
think you'll... exactly. Debbie Does Dallas in space. So I'm watching it, and it's this girl, and she's left behind, and all the other people have left the Earth, and then the guy that plays Falcon, Anthony Mackie, shows up. And
is this going to be a spoiler in here?
No, I turned it off. Oh. I turned it off. Because I had this epiphany that Netflix is putting so much stuff out there, like trying to satisfy their subscribers and stuff, that I think they're putting not the best quality of movie out there.
Oh, yeah, they have.
But they're slapping a name like, you're going to watch this because it's got Anthony Mackie and he's a big star.
Well,
like
they
that
need
Bird
to,
Box thing with Sandra Bullock.
Right.
That was a Twilight Zone mediocre episode. That would have been like 22 minutes.
But it had Sandra Bullock.
But it had John Malkovich and
Sandra
Bullock.
But it had Sandra Bullock who doesn't do TV. So
you're
basically
thinking,
it's like,
this is a big thing, and I'm watching it going, this is stupid. It wasn't the great. Did you finally watch it?
No.
Oh, well, you're not missing much. But the people blindfolded.
I have nothing against it. There's just too much to watch.
I know, but the thing is, I'm like, this was like New Year's Eve, and everybody was talking
Although
about
I did drive here blindfolded just for the
did
fun
Did you really?
Of it. Yeah,
I know, I'm doing this podcast
I don't think I hit
blindfold.
Anything.
No.
but I heard a couple crunches.
I'm thinking now, Netflix isn't, because I started scrolling down trying
but
to find
about
something
volume
to watch.
Too. They're about they volume
are,
two.
But they have, you know what I end up doing? I end up watching stuff I've already seen because it's comforting. I go, oh,
and that's why people do sequels, though.
Let me watch the
that's why people
Infinity
do sequels,
War.
Because
it's
you think
movie.
I've already seen this.
Yeah.
You know, I might like this.
Like, but that's a TV show mentality. Yeah. That's episodic.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, Friends.
Right.
It's the same show.
Right.
It's a comic book.
Right.
It doesn't change.
Right.
We just move it around a little bit. It's the same
well,
story.
I watched
all those Superman things. Remember you told me that?
Right, the TV
you
shows.
You watched all
five
seasons, right?
No, I just watched the first season.
The first season's the only good one.
Yeah, no, I remember. I've seen them all. Yeah. But no, what I was going to say is I go through, and this is me being...
Picky.
I go through the New York Times. They do movie reviews on, like, Friday paper. They'll do the reviews for film festival stuff. So it's usually stuff that's not big releases, right?
Right.
I look at the titles. I go, oh, that sounds interesting. I type it into Netflix, and I put it in my waiting list or my, because it's not
the
out
queue.
Yet on
a...
Right. So you can put it into your saved...
Right.
And then I'll get these things, and they're interesting, and they're good movies. They're just not movies that are
mass
being
media.
Theatrically released, even.
Like Glass. I thought I'd go see that because Sharon went away.
Right.
If it wasn't freezing out yesterday, I would have gone to the movies, right? But then I read all the reviews, and they said it sucks.
Right.
And my head's like, oh.
Do you
want to
invest
go waste
that time?
2 hours sitting in a bad movie.
Right.
But I should have my own point of view. I shouldn't have somebody
tell
me.
But that's the advantage of going on Thursday night before
that's
the reviews.
That's why we usually go before it starts, because I don't want to hear everybody. Because if I went to Aquaman after it opened,
you
I would have said...
Would you?
No, because I heard everyone said it sucked.
Oh, yeah.
And then it made all that money, so then I'm like, oh, maybe I should go.
Right.
And then Bumblebee,
right.
which I knew about ahead of time before it came out, somebody said it's the big yellow iron giant.
It's good. I
really
liked it. But my
son Owen saw it, and he came back and said, no, it was actually good. I go, really? Because I heard it was just, he goes, yeah, it's similar,
it's
but
it was still well done. Yeah, no, it was well done.
And then I kicked myself and go, oh, maybe I should have seen that.
You see it on DVD.
No, but if I go to the movies, I got to see it in the IMAX. Yeah. I want to see it on the big.
No, it was good. It was
giant screen.
It was nicely done, and it had a more human
like Spider-Verse
approach. Yeah,
I went and saw it twice. It didn't make a lot of money, but it was. I thought it was phenomenal.
Yeah, it's
the
a great movie.
Art-wise, and the story.
Yeah, no,
good.
Visually beautiful. It's a nice story. Yeah, that was the best superhero.
I think that was one of the best movies last year, actually, for a cartoon.
Yeah. So no, I like that a lot too.
But I mean, you know what I saw was horrible? First Man. The one with Neil Armstrong.
Oh, you just didn't like that?
Oh, God, it was boring. Because Sharon ruined it. Well, how could she ruin it?
She said they did land on the moon.
She goes, I'm going to tell you how it ends. He lands on the moon and comes home. Shut up. Spoiler alert. I knew that, of course. But they don't really add anything to the legend of Neil Armstrong.
Right.
Because you never knew much about him.
Right.
And you're not going to learn much about him now. Because he was just that kind of guy in real life. He didn't talk about everything.
He's a self-contained.
Did his job. One would look at him. I even said, Sharon, does he have some type of like Asperger's or something? Because
he was just dedicated. Those guys also
He was very quiet. Just did his job. He was very focused.
But I know
people.
He wasn't
Buzz Aldrin, who's like the opposite spectrum. Who's on TV, dancing with the stars.
Right, right.
What's his name? Kept to himself and didn't bother anybody. That's it.
So I watched a movie last night on my... I still get DVDs from Netflix. Yeah. And I just saw the teaser on a previous movie that I watched. Mm. And I was like, oh, that looks interesting. And again, they're not like big budget.
Yeah.
It was
Ed
Harris. And it was like a... what you'd almost say like a romance, but it had gothic aspects to it.
A what?
Like a romance. This woman's husband
with
dies.
Ed Harris?
Yeah.
Oh.
And then she's mourning him, but it's not like mopey mourning, right?
Is this new?
It was came out in 2013.
Oh, okay.
And then 5 years later, she's out and about at this art gallery, and she sees somebody who's a dead ringer for him. And then she basically stalks him and they become involved. But she can't let anybody that knew her husband meet this guy because he's a dead ringer, and they'd all be like, you're just living in the past.
Yeah.
It was an interesting...
him.
I mean...
I thought it was Jackson Pollock, because he did play Jackson Pollock in a movie.
But he plays a painter in here, too. He was an architect as the guy who dies, and then he's a painter as the woman. It was... why can't I remember her name? Warren Beatty's wife, Annette Bening.
Oh, Annette Bening, yeah.
And it was beautifully done. And it was interesting and challenging, but I doubt that it's a mainstream thing.
No, I didn't.
To me, it was interesting because it was like, how are they going to get out of this? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because most romantic things have something that the one person hides from the other, and then it comes out, and then they break up.
Yeah.
That's the theme for every romantic movie. It was just interesting. Yeah. And previously, I watched I watched something called Nostalgia with John Hamm. Mm. That was very interesting, and it was like... again, just like a slice of life. So those movies kind of fill that void of what I think of as like a lot of the 70s stuff, outside of the really well-known, big, big successful 70s movies.
Watching documentaries.
There was a lot of good stuff.
I don't know why, but I've become my father.
Yeah.
He would sit there and watch a thing about bugs.
Right.
You come home and watch about praying mantis.
I read stuff like that, tend not to watch
it. No, I told you I watched this documentary about this artist from Poland who was... you know, dealing with the Nazis.
That
was great. Then there was another thing, how things are made. Then they have one thing called 7 days before. Have you seen that?
No.
There's the Super Bowl, and they'll show you the prep that goes into
so you see what's behind
the scenes.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, that's cool, because I do big events, so
right,
I like to see how other people do
it
and what they have to put up with. They don't have to put up with, oh, no, Christopher Priest needs chapstick, which happened last year on the floor. He's like, hey, Mitch. Right. Hey, Chris. You got any chapstick? I'm like, what? No. I need some. My lips are cracked. Hold on. And next thing I'm looking for chapstick, and Lou Ferrigno's texting me that he needs a steak dinner,
and
it's 2 in the morning.
Right.
See, I could write a book about that stuff. The names would be changed.
Maybe you need to do your
I do my
documentary.
Own documentary called The Confidential. Terrific Confidential.
Just don't use two ends.
I've had fist fights. I've had people that can't sit next to other people. You know, for their own reasons.
Yeah.
But I've done it, too. I've gone to shows, and other people I don't like to are sitting nearby me, and I go up to the promoter and go, could you please move my table?
I remember being at that show.
I know. I was there.
Can
was
we
like,
not be here?
Can we not sit next to this guy? And he doesn't know.
Yeah.
He's like, why? Is there a problem? I go, yeah. Because I don't like that
person. But everybody's... I mean, again, that's part of working. You can work with somebody, and you can get along, and you can work with some people and not get along, but still be friends.
See, there was never ever a real bullpen. I think people think it looks like something on TV where an ad is easy.
Well, there was a bullpen.
Where they're all sitting next to each other.
Like in the 60s, when everybody had to live nearby.
Yeah.
I mean, you had some guys living in California who mailed stuff in, but that was risky.
In the 60s?
Like Alex Toth was on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah. Most of them were on Long Island.
But you had to be able to commute to New York to drop work off because they wouldn't trust the mail.
Right.
That was how it worked. So you could... the bullpen was, here's your group of people who are working here all the time, and here's the people who come in every Friday. So that concept is valid. And oftentimes when I first moved, I would go into the... I would go up on a Friday, and we'd go out to dinner as a big group.
You said it was like you, Zach, and a bunch of people.
And it was either a Marvel group or a DC group.
Yeah.
And since Carlin worked for both, it could be either.
Yeah.
You know, and they were fun, and that was your socializing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when you went up to the office, Marvel had a bullpen.
Yeah.
DC had a production department.
No,
they were different.
Kupferberg, he said when he went to work there in the 70s, there was literally typewriters outside of...
No,
Kerry Bates and Elliot Nagin would type
Superman scripts outside his office.
And then what would they do? Put them on a fax machine to send them to the artist or something?
No, Kurt Swan would come in and pick up a script.
Oh.
Yeah, they weren't doing much mailing. I think the first time I heard of... and this is like, I worked there in 1980, and they started letting people work outside of the region. So I was able to mail in jobs. But that's when FedEx started coming about.
They said, how did you know you were doing well? He said, when you'd go back and there'd be another script waiting for you.
Yeah,
that's how you knew you were doing a good job.
But Kurt Swan would have to drop off pages and he would take a script home.
Yeah.
That's how it worked. So everybody timed it for that. But you also could come in and get a check. Mm-hmm. You weren't waiting on a check being mailed. You could come in on a Friday, get a check for that job, take it home. Oh. So there was an added bonus to being able to get there.
Yeah.
Same with getting original art back. If you went in to get your art back, you might have got a pick of pages, even though it was technically supposed to be random.
Right.
You could come in and say, if I was the penciler, where are my 14 out of 22 pages?
Yeah, because the inker got some.
The inker would get a third, basically, supposed to how it worked.
They weren't selling those pages, though, were they? There was no internet.
People sold them, yeah.
What, at conventions?
They sold them at shows. They sold them through the mail.
Oh,
Buyer's Guide ads, fanzine ads, yeah.
The artist would put ads like Kurt Swan?
No, you'd have to put your work in consignment with someone who is an art dealer, and then they would sell it. Yeah.
Yeah, but they were selling for a song, though, right?
It was
$20.
It depended. But I mean, $20 was
a lot of money.
When your page rate was $20. $20 was a lot of money to put out for artwork.
And that would just be the artist would get that money. He didn't have to share it with anybody. So no, you'd get paid twice.
You would have to share it with whoever was selling.
No,
like
I
say,
but
it was on consignment, and then you'd get screwed by the art dealer because they either never paid you or they went out of business.
Has that happened?
Sure.
Really?
Yeah, I got screwed out of All-Star Squadron pages that...
Somebody sold for you and you never got the money?
Yeah, a local...
Really?
Yeah, yeah. They had pages, and then they basically went out of business. And how do you contact them when they're out of business and you're dealing through the mail?
Did you ever find those pages?
No. Nope.
Really? Put a post up, say, hey, did anyone buy these?
I still have the circular that they put out, the little catalog, so I know which pages they are.
No shit.
But yeah, yeah.
Well, that sucks.
And that happened with other people. I mean, that's the nature of it, you know?
Hmm.
I mean, that's why art dealers back then, to me, that's why I always had a bad feeling about art dealers. It took a long time to trust
anybody.
Those guys
had shops or anything, right?
No. And it wasn't even like, in some cases, it wasn't even like maybe they went to a convention in New York. Well, if I'm in Wisconsin, I have no way of knowing if they sold a page.
Oh, I see.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the good thing about the internet is you can certainly sell your stuff yourself. Or if someone's selling it, you control it.
The guy I talked to who hangs out with Joe Sinnott, he says he's trying to start a new thing where he's doing an online catalog to verify that so-and-so did a piece of art.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you buy a Joe Sinnott
page. Oh, right, right.
Because it's not that hard to copy.
Yeah.
Somebody could, if they're really good at it. Like, I don't know.
Well,
I could
now,
walk in and buy a Gil Kane. You could get me a piece of paper.
See, the problem.
Reproduce it.
Yeah.
I could think it's original Gil Kane.
The problem now is that the lettering's not on the artwork. So
yeah, no, it's not. So
you could probably fake something.
Yeah.
People try it, but it's mostly sketches that are getting faked.
Yeah.
You see it on eBay a lot, and they don't have the interest.
He said there was a guy trying to sell Kirby pages.
Yeah.
And I think the guy bought them, and he said, those aren't real.
Yeah.
Because Joe Sinnott knew it. He goes, I worked on those. Those aren't Jack's pages.
Yeah. And sometimes people would just lightbox it and call it a Kirby drawing. And technically it is, but you should accredit that you lightboxed it from something.
But they would charge good money for it?
Yeah. I mean, when I did covers for the Kirby Collector, I was working off of a Xerox of a Kirby pencil page.
Right.
And when I create it, it's now me
after
technically
Kirby.
Inking Kirby, but... there's probably still an original in existence somewhere of that pencil page.
And
you know what I'm saying?
If somebody doesn't know what they're looking at, they probably could be sold.
Yeah, but I mean, mine was in print.
Yeah.
So you can look and go, oh, that was in print.
Printed piece. Yeah.
But if you did it as a fan, who's to say where that was used or maybe never published? That's where you can get away with a lot of stuff because there's so much. The Kirby Collector's been printing pencils of Kirby pages for ages. That's been around for 20 years or whatever. So that's a long time and a lot of pages that are available to somebody to basically print a blue line on and ink.
Mm-hmm. You know? To bring this back full circle, I was offered right where we sit, right down the street on my 30th birthday, guy had Star Wars pages because I was a big Star Wars fan, and he had 5 pages from the original Star Wars Marvel book. 2 of them were Howard Chaykin, issue 7, Star Wars, Howard Chaykin Star Wars pages.
Right.
And the rest were Carmine Infantino.
From a little later?
From issue 20,
issue
18. So I bought the Carmine Infantino pages for a song.
You still have them?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
for like
cool.
$20.
Those are Tom Palmer, right?
Tom Palmer. No.
Or were they Klaus?
No. Bob
Wyacek. Oh, cool.
Inked them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got Wyacek, Carmen Infantino artwork, but I didn't buy the Chaykin pages.
Oh, interesting.
Which had the big bunny on it.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't buy those. I should have. Huh. Because God knows how much they're worth. But
well, you don't remember how much they were selling them for.
$25
$25 Yeah. Again, it's money that...
This is 1996.
Not, but it's still money that you have to come up with outside
of
whatever.
Yeah, $25 wasn't much. Yeah. Know? I don't think that was what they were supposed to go for.
And you don't know what the history
of those...
Worst
case I ever had was there was an artist named... I can't think. He drew Indiana Jones books. He was down south. Something with an S. Anyway, he sold me a page, a splash page. Mm-hmm. And he said it's about $80. And then I went to the dealer, somebody you know.
Yep.
Woman. And then she said, oh, that's 100 something.
Huh.
I said, are you sure about that? She goes, yeah. And then I flipped over the page, and there was written in pencil $80.
Oh.
So she was marking it up for her cut, which is fine.
Was this Sam Della Rosa?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I'm trying to think of the artist's name. He's a southern guy. Steve, I think his first name was. But he was doing an Indiana Jones book for Dark Horse.
Okay.
He did 3 out of 4. He couldn't finish the last one.
Huh.
And they pulled him and they put another artist
on
it.
Yeah.
But,
I was thinking of the Marvel stuff.
No. But anyway, I just remember that. But I bought something from her. But he drew it. He was right there. He told me that's my page. That's why I was like, when they're not around, you kind of wonder sometimes,
well,
like, is that legit?
You also, I mean, I remember buying John Buscema pages in the late 90s.
Yeah. Conan pages?
No, they were contemporary pages that he was still working on.
Oh,
and they were super cheap because...
He was doing the breakdowns,
people,
right?
No, everybody wanted the early Avengers or the Conans or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. So I bought Punisher. He did like Punisher Warzone.
Mm.
He did Avengers Annual
in
like 96 or something like that, seven.
Yeah.
And I bought these pages for like 15, 20
the
bucks
pencils,
a page.
Or were they inked?
Fully inked. And he inked them.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. And I was like, for
how much?
A fan... They were hard to pass up.
Yeah, how much were they again?
They were like 15, 20,
that's it?
$25.
Oh, wow, that's cheap.
And it was because people didn't value his current work. They valued
his older stuff.
And it's very short-sighted because now, I mean, not that I would sell them, but those pages, any John Buscema page is like really super expensive now.
Oh, yeah? Well,
it's because he's no longer doing them.
Yeah.
I mean, the same was true of Kirby. Kirby, the pages from the later Kirby stuff, like Mr. Machine and, you know, the Devil
Captain
Dinosaur
Victory
era.
Yeah.
Those were a little cheaper because people wanted that 60s stuff.
I
think it was originally Mr. Machine, and then
they changed
it.
Yeah, they changed the name to Machine Man. Yeah.
But, I mean, that's, again, it's a case where you value somebody differently because they've been around producing work for, like, 40 years. And then when they're no longer producing that,
so,
and you can't get anything
there,
new.
See, I can wrap this up because it goes all the way back to where we started over an hour ago.
Right.
Kirby stuff, they equate him.
Right.
Just like Buscema, you said they wanted the Avengers stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what they wanted. They don't want his new stuff
or
his current stuff.
But this
they
is,
want the
that
old
does
stuff.
Tie into
and
Howard's
And that goes back
thing.
To
yeah.
the Howard's thing where
yeah.
he's doing book now, but they
yeah.
want the stuff he did 40 years ago. Because that's...
And it's probably frustrating for him to write that and draw that book. And to have a more limited audience, whereas...
Knowing that his style is better now than it was four decades now. And you go, wait, you want the stuff that was hackneyed?
Yeah.
Like my hack...
Yeah.
You even said it was a hack job.
Yeah.
He just did it to get
But don't
it
you think...
I
mean, and again, Starlin went through that period where he did Marvel stuff early on.
Yeah.
And his work was more Kirby-esque and Gil Kane-esque. And then the more he refined his work...
He got his own style.
Right. But he also... A lot of people still like that early stuff.
Oh, really?
Because it was
Ooh.
More... It was more action oriented or whatever.
That Iron Man stuff you did.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
people
no,
love
that.
When I used to have these conversations in the comic store, and I'd say, "Well, he's developing as an artist." It's like the argument with Byrne too. Byrne started out.
So
he
Neil
had a
Adams.
Really Neil. He had a Neil look, but he had a good style.
Yeah.
But by the time he was doing Superman, he was drawing better.
Yeah.
In other words, his drawing had gotten better, and no artist wants to necessarily think, you only like the crappy old stuff.
Yeah.
So I could see where Howard's, you know what I mean? That point of view is maybe he knows he could do better than that.
Right.
Now it's hard to like go, well, that's the stuff you're going to point out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess it would be like you said with Steve Martin using that example. It's like someone saying, what movie have you done since The Jerk?
The Jerk. Yeah, it's
you
like,
know?
Are you kidding me?
Right.
Roxanne,
I mean,
it was up for Academy Award.
But I'm just saying, that's what you always run into. You can't be bothered by it.
Yeah.
It's
I remember
just the
Robin
way people
Williams,
are.
They said he walked down the street, people yelled, hey, Mork. That's it.
Yeah.
Forget the Academy Awards, forget Goodwill Hunting.
Robin Williams was in that movie
that
I just mentioned. the one with Ed Harris. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. He
Must
played
be
the
one
neighbor.
Of his last movies.
I don't remember when he had passed away because this was 2013. So
yeah, 4 years ago.
And it was a supporting role, but it's like, I always liked him.
Yeah, no, I don't watch Robin Williams movies anymore. That's weird. Like if they're on, I can't watch them because I keep going.
There's a sadness built into it.
Yeah. It's like no matter what happens.
Yeah.
And then he's in a couple movies where he kills himself.
Yeah.
So it's even more surreal to watch that. Like, oh, The Fisher King was my favorite one.
Yeah.
Of all the Robin Williams movies, that was my favorite with him and Jeff Bridges looking for the Holy Grail.
Right.
His wife is killed.
Yep.
That was a great movie.
Well, he was in Insomnia.
Oh, when he played the
serial killer? That was a Christopher Nolan. That was a remake.
That was one of his?
Yeah, it was Al Pacino.
Yeah.
It was like set
that.
In.
Wasn't that the one where he's the film?
Or no,
developer?
He was. Was
no,
he in that one?
That was an 8-hour photo or something.
But I think he might have been in Insomnia too. It was the one where he played the film developer. Was that
yeah,
other one?
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
a different one. But he played like bad guys in a couple of movies in that period. They were definitely creepy.
Yeah.
But no. I think he was the bad guy in Insomnia. He was the killer or something. Not the spoiler
alert.
Yeah,
he was a killer in two movies. One was the film developer, and the other one. Insomnia. They were almost like the same movie. That's why I'm like, wait. And they came out within a year of each other, too.
Yeah, and it was right before Nolan.
1 hour photo? Wasn't that what it was called?
Yeah, but the Nolan one was right
Which
before
they don't even
Batman.
Have anymore.
But right before Batman Begins.
Yeah.
That was he was that was why.
But there is no such thing as a 1 hour photo anymore.
Yeah, but that's why he was at. That's why he was in Warner Brothers' purview, was because he had just done
that
movie
for
Warner, and for he then
Begins?
Pitched it. Yeah.
I thought it was that other movie he did with Tom Cruise. Magnolia? Wasn't that
he
it?
Didn't do Magnolia.
What was the one he did where he had to go back in time? Or it was Guy Pearce? They have to tell the story
Inception.
Backwards?
Inception.
No, it was before Inception.
I mean, no.
They,
yeah, no,
they
no.
Based
I,
it
I,
on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, I know.
Jerry Seinfeld did an episode.
Yeah.
Like that's
But this it. Other one came after. It was right before. Like the
What
one,
the hell was that movie?
Good.
Where did they go
yeah,
back?
Yeah, I know what you're talking. It was
He's
out of order.
He's got clues
yeah,
right now.
Yeah. No, I know.
It's not,
but that was actually, I think that was like maybe 2003, then I think the other one was 2004.
I don't know. Now my brain's just stuck on what that movie was called.
Because the Insomnia was based on a Norwegian film or something. It's like a remake of a and it's, you know, the fish out of water, literally the cop from the big city in the middle of Alaska or something.
I'm listening to you, but my brain's trying to think of that story. What, it's a one
it's
word
a,
name.
Yeah, that's why I said Inception, because it's like that. It's something
Magnolia.
With that. Well, you could probably look it up on your phone
it up.
If
I
you really want.
I
want
to use my brain cells.
The brain cells are gone.
I know. Dan used to do that. He always would look. I'm like, don't you dare use your phone.
But
remember it, man.
The problem is, I do this, like I said, when I was thinking about Annette Bening, I was like, what is her name? What is her name? And then the minute I thought of Warren Beatty, I was like, oh, Annette
Bening.
See,
I think of Annette Bening, I think of The Grifters.
Yeah.
She was in that movie.
She's still an attractive woman.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. She's in the new Captain Marvel movie.
I heard that, yeah.
I don't know who she plays.
Oh, did you see the new Shazam trailer?
I did. It looked funny when he's trying to buy beer. And they're sitting. Then he has to get a lair.
Right.
They're
sitting.
Like
they're sitting with the
realtor. By the water, by some rocks, and they're staring at him. It's like, that.
But the
that
action,
looks funny.
The action shots look good too.
Yeah.
The shot of him jumping off the roof and transforming
and
was pretty awesome.
Yeah. I hope it's a good movie. See, now that I think DC figured it out, they're not going to do the world building. We're not going to do that Avengers thing like they did.
Right.
We're going to just do standalone movies. And you know what? That'll probably work.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But I do wish Henry Cavill popped in because he was supposed to be in it. You know.
I want to see a Man of Steel too.
They're not
Why
doing
are
it?
They not doing that?
Because it's over.
I'm just saying.
Zack
he was
Snyder's
a good
gone.
Superman.
Everything's gone.
Yeah. It's a shame because Henry was a good Superman.
The Batman movies being reworked now.
Well, I heard recently that maybe Affleck is still circling that.
Oh, I think he's done.
No, he was saying that based on this like script, I guess he's been working with the...
They should have done like
is it Matt Reeves?
Yeah.
That he was working with him on the script and that he might be back in it. It's got Nightwing supposedly.
An
that's
older
the
older Batman story.
Yeah, well, that's what when they first were talking about Superman before Man of Steel. Mm. You know, they were trying to cast. They were at the time. The rumor was about Dark Knight and doing like the old Batman and old Superman.
Oh, an old
That's
Superman?
What they were talking before they wound up with Man of Steel. They were discussing the possibility of doing that because I think I remember they talked about John Hamm.
Yeah.
As Superman.
Oh, as Superman?
Yeah.
I've heard him as Batman.
So, I mean,
I've never heard him as that.
But again, you know, that's kind of a dumb way to launch a series.
As old?
Right.
Yeah, so because if it takes off, like,
you then have
you
that
now?
Problem, right? It's like
even True if, Grit. You don't do the Adventure of Rooster Cogburn.
Because they did this with, I mean, they did it with Affleck. They've kind of de-aged him by the time it's Justice League.
He was younger than he was in
Right, he doesn't have the gray hair or whatever.
No, I was
right.
wondering that too. I'm like, why does he look younger?
Because someone said, oops, you know, how old do we want this guy? Batman, the retirement years.
I still watched, there's none of the elements of Aquaman that were in Justice League show up in the movie. It's like, doesn't exist.
And
it rewrites
I
the
liked
story.
How he was in Justice League. That was what made me excited about the
movie.
Because
he was like a biker
guy.
Hey, man, yo, bro.
Yeah.
Nope,
I think.
Nope. Done. Doesn't exist. It's like Highlander 2.
And did you, somebody posted online, they posted the, what Mira looked like in the.
Yeah, she didn't have that bad wig.
But I'm saying in the Justice League, the Snyder cut things, she had like the tiara that covered, which was perfect, and the costume looked better to me.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
I know it's, you know, you're choosing, but at least that would have eliminated the possibility of having
that bad wig
being so obvious.
The movie looks more like a Power Rangers movie.
Yeah, when you see that, you do think of like Power Rangers or something, because it was just.
Too much.
For no reason, it's like purpley red.
Nicole Kidman, Oscar winning. Here, put on this dead fish head in a lobster claw. She must be like, what am I doing in this movie? I just remember seeing her, though. Seriously? Really?
Academy Award winning.
Academy Award winning. It's like when they had Laurence Olivier in Clash of the Titans.
Right.
Okay. I'm talking to the
I'm dying now, but my family will get this money.
Probably that's what happened.
Yeah.
He did that movie towards the end. It was like, Laurence Olivier is Zeus.
Right. I mean, it was cool.
It was stupid.
And it takes, but I'm saying if the movie were better.
Yeah, the movie was like Max von Sydow.
But it takes, it's like having.
Flash Gordon.
Right, but it's like having Anthony Hopkins playing
Thor,
Odin.
Yeah.
It's perfect, but if you can put him in a good movie, it works.
He wasn't good in that Transformers movie. I didn't even see it the last night.
Well, then how do you know he wasn't any good in it?
Because the movie was bad.
Mr. Smarty Pants.
Yeah, whatever. That wraps it up. I've been talking too long. Hour and 15 minutes. Good luck if you're listening to this. All right. You got anything else?
Yeah, just listen to it on that commute from whatever
I
you're,
know, if you're doing
home
a long
to
drive,
work.
We're taking the place of the static on the radio. All right. That's it.
Thank you for listening.
No, we used to say that's that, but we don't say that anymore.
Okay.
That's how it used to end.
Okay.
And that's that.
What's the new catchphrase? The end.
Okay.
Everyone dies.
Really original. Wow, you write stories for a living?
Everyone dies.
That's a really. All right, everyone dies at the end. Wow, that's depressing.
That's my Superman line.
Watch that Robin Williams movie.
That's
now.
My Superman line. The end, everyone dies. That's how the death of Superman came about.
Oh, all right. This has been a production of Big Fedora Marketing, LLC. The folks that bring you the terrific Comic-Con, Gamer-Con, and so much more. Thanks for listening. Okay, goodbye.